Masters in Business is brought to you by the American Arbitration Association. Business disputes are inevitable. Resolve faster with the American Arbitration Association, the global leader in alternative dispute resolution for over 90 years. Learn more at ADR.org.
This is Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
This week on the podcast, I sit down with author and journalist Duff McDonald. He has written such seminal books as Last Man Standing, The Ascent of Jamie Dimon and J.P. Morgan Chase. His second book was The Firm, The Story of McKinsey and Its Secret Influence on American Business. And what's shocking about that book, not only that McKinsey is as influential as it is in government and finance and business in general, but given their storied history and their power and influence, this was literally the first book ever written on McKinsey. That's pretty shocking. Full disclosure, I myself have referenced Duff's work, and about a half a dozen years ago, I wrote something called Is McKinsey the Root of All Evil? And the answer turned out, in my opinion, to more or less have been yes. His book is really a deep and detailed read into the storied firm, and it's quite fascinating. His most recent book is The Golden Passport, Harvard Business School and the Limits of Capitalism and the Moral Failure of the MBA Elite. It is also a deeply researched and highly critical look at one of the most significant institutions in the world of fill-in-the-blank, government, finance, business, etc. What I love about Duff's work is that it's not just opinion or visceral like or dislike. These are really deep dives, richly researched pieces of work into an institution, the people involved, the impact it's had on not only the world of business and finance and government, but just how it fits into the overall skew of society, including things like what's the impact of our business school on economic inequality. And he approaches this from a very, very objective, nonpartisan approach. I found all of his books to be absolutely fascinating, and I think you'll find the conversation we had quite interesting as well. So with no further ado, my conversation with Duff McDonald. My special guest today is Duff McDonald. He is a contributing editor at the New York Observer. He has previously contributed as an editor at New York Magazine, Fortune, and other fine publications. He has written pretty much for every major business publication from Fortune, Business Week, Condé Nast Portfolio, GQ, Wired. He has won numerous national magazine awards and is the author of numerous books. The one that caught my attention was The Firm, The Story of McKinsey and Its Secret Influence on American Business. But he has also written Last Man Standing, The Ascent of Jamie Dimon and J.P. Morgan Chase. And his most recent book is The Golden Passport, Harvard Business School, The Limits of Capitalism, and the Moral Failure of the MBA Elite. Duff McDonald, welcome to Bloomberg.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start out talking a little bit about your career in journalism. What attracted you to writing about business?
It's funny you should ask. I went to Wharton as an undergraduate, a little unwittingly. I was from Toronto, and I did not have a sense of Wall Street at the time. Mm-hmm. I was interested in being a businessman, which is what I told my guidance counselor.
Right.
So he told me to go to a business school, so I did. And I did well enough there and got a job at Goldman Sachs out of undergrad.
It's not that you wanted to, but it's the law. You come out of Wharton and
there
that's pretty much,
yeah.
There's a line. You could go to Goldman Sachs here. You could go to McKinsey there. There's a whole bunch of options.
Exactly. Although I kind of stumped my classmates. I only got one job offer from Goldman Sachs. And apparently if you get one from Goldman, you're supposed to have gotten one from everybody else too. But I worked there for 2 years in corporate finance.
Mm-hmm.
And while impressed with the quality of the talent and the, you know, they know what they're doing there.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't for me. And I actually tried to get a job in book publishing first and couldn't get hired.
So there was nothing available in steam engines? You were looking into businesses that were soon going to collapse?
Exactly. So thank you, publishing industry, for not hiring me and merely hiring me later. And then a friend suggested journalism, and I looked into...
So you had never really been thinking about writing? Has there been previous authorship, any writing casually even?
Not on the side. Like, I was a capable writer, but I don't think I ever once said I want to be a writer. And so back to your question, how did I get into business journalism? It's because to get into journalism, I needed to write about business.
So that was your entree.
Yeah.
And that's pretty fascinating. What does your process look like? How do you figure out what you want to write about? And how do you begin covering a specific topic? The areas you have written about, both in print and in books, is a pretty broad cross-section of American finance.
Yeah, I basically tend to follow my interest, you know, wherever it lands.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe I shouldn't say that my choice of topic is somewhat random, but I, after a point in my career, got to a point where I could, you know, I knew enough editors that I could get assignments with good story ideas. So it was just about a good story. And
you were pitching ideas to them, and most of the time they liked it.
Yeah, and in the other direction. So, you know, it's following just sort of my interest. But if you look at the three books, they all sort of follow each other. Jamie Dimon was the first one, because I'd had a cover story in New York Magazine after the fall of Bear Stearns, which we sold as a book. And then McKinsey followed that because Jamie himself, who's notoriously anti-consultant, it didn't resonate enough with me at the time that I thought, oh, that's my next book, but enough that it was in the book about Jamie.
Mm-hmm.
And my editor said, what about what he said about McKinsey? What do you think? And I looked into it and I was like, I can't believe no one's written a book
about
these guys.
I was about to say, it's astonishing that they've been around as long as they have been and are as influential as they are. No one has really called them to task.
I think it's because they probably never cooperated.
Mm-hmm.
And
did they cooperate with you?
They did. They did not at first. We used the age-old, book is happening anyway, thing that we use in magazine journalism.
Sure. You can either help shape it or just come out and you can read it with everybody else and I promise you won't be happy.
And the shocker is that McKinsey came around and then you get to the third book, Harvard Business School, and that came about just because, you know, McKinsey and Harvard have been connected.
For a long time.
And they are the only one of the three subjects that refused to speak to me at all.
That's interesting. Is your process, I know some people research, and then they finish the research, and they write, and other people research, write. How do you approach covering a subject?
Like
McKinsey and Harvard Business School, two fairly giant subjects.
I'm more of the former, where I sort of try to front load the research.
Uh-huh.
I found through the three books that the hardest part of writing a book, at least for me, is the middle part.
Uh-huh.
Organizing what you know and getting ready to write. Because reporting, if you enjoy it and have a whatever capability at it, it's not that hard. You're just talking to people.
And you're doing 1,000 words, and it's a fairly clear structure.
Yeah.
On the other hand, 100,000 words, that's a very different structure.
So the first time I did that, it nearly broke my mind. I was like, I don't even know how to take this word file and start cutting and paste, the sort of just manual challenge was sort of terrifying. But I do research at first, organization, then writing. But by the time you're writing is when you know the most about the subject. So you do go back and look into things that you stumble on at that point in the process.
How much of Harvard Business School is part of that group that the national populist movement around the world is tilting against?
before I looked into it, I think if you'd asked me, I would have guessed that HBS was, you know, dominant in both business and government leadership positions. One of the things that's really interesting about them, as opposed to, say, Harvard Law School or other places, is there are precious few Harvard MBAs that ever have a career in government. You know, they go in at the top, like Hank Paulson,
right,
or something like that. But like, if you look at the top 1,000 people in the federal government, you probably find 5 Harvard MBAs.
That's all.
Yeah. So they are not part of the governing elite, except if you
think that corporations
are essentially ruling this country.
Well, to a large degree, they have been.
Yeah. So in that regard, they are. I think the FT came out with a survey, its latest survey of the 5,000 largest companies in the world, or the 1,000 mm-hmm. or something. And MBAs were not dominant as a percentage of CEOs, but of those CEOs that were MBAs, Harvard was totally dominant. They had more than twice as many as the closest one, which I think was Stanford or INSEAD. So they have a long history of accelerating people's climb to the top of whatever greasy pole they're climbing.
Let me throw a quote of yours at you and see what you have to say about this. Harvard Business School has not only proven an enormous failure, but its very success has made it positively dangerous. Discuss.
I think that one of the things that they have consistently failed to do is to teach their students that hierarchy and success does not equal does not mean that you are right, and does not mean that you are wise. And part of that has to do with the fact that you can't pitch yourself as a graduate school of Harvard where your mission is to make boatloads of money.
Right.
So what they sell themselves as is educating enlightened leaders, and these enlightened leaders are convinced of their own destiny as leaders from the get-go, and they confuse all sorts of other inputs for their essential correctness and rightness, and then, you know, make decisions based on that. And it's like they've confused the ability to make money with wisdom.
Huh. So let me throw another of your quotes back at you. Harvard Business School has contributed to pretty much every bad thing that has happened in American business and the economy over the past century. Now, is that a fact or a slight exaggeration?
Did I write that?
I'm paraphrasing.
Oh, okay. So I wouldn't want to, like, you know, a couple of reviewers have said that I blame the recent financial crisis on them.
Mm-hmm.
I did not.
I don't recall seeing anything.
Yeah, like, and in the book, what I took issue with was Dean J. Light in the immediate aftermath of the crisis saying, we don't want to spend time looking to fix blame. That's not interesting, but we must be part of the solution.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at the list of HBS grads who are in positions of authority in the lead up to the crisis,
right,
you have George W. Bush, you have Christopher Cox, you have Hank Paulson, you have Jamie Dimon, you have
go down the
whoever
down
else
that
at Goldman Sachs.
Merrill Lynch, Morgan Stanley.
So John Thane, right, John Paulson. So you have it like that. In no way was I like, it's their fault, but it's like, wait a second. When we're making a list of people to figure out how to not do this again, I don't think you have earned the right to be at the head of that line. You were at the head of it leading into this thing.
The metaphor I like is when a surgical procedure is botched, you always send in a fresh surgeon to fix it who is not looking to cover up the previous snafu. He's just going in, or she's just going in, to do what they need to do. When you send somebody to fix something where they may have had a hand in the creation
absolutely
of the problem, you're not going to get, and that's been a pretty fair criticism of having Geithner and Larry Summers as part of the cleanup crew. Are they there to clean up, or are they there to clean up their reputation? It's hard to tell.
Yeah, and Hank Paulson, you know, credited with stabilizing a clearly mm-hmm. precarious situation. But that was not his only motivation at the time. He was motivated to save Goldman Sachs. He mm-hmm. was motivated to There were sweetheart deals with Goldman all over the place. So again, was it their fault? We can't really blame anyone, but they certainly weren't without fault,
to say the least. So here's a question that I'm curious about. So you referenced Stanford. You went to Wharton. There's the Booth School at Chicago, Columbia, Tuck at Dartmouth. You go down the list of high-ranked MBA programs. It seems like there's a lot of competition. Is Harvard Business School still it, or have some of these other really well-regarded entities cut a little bit into their space?
I can answer that question with a quote that's in the book. I can't remember who said it, so I apologize to its source now. But they said, if you want your grandparents to be impressed, go to Harvard Business School. If you want your grandkids to be impressed, go to Stanford.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah,
I read recently there are 76,000 Harvard MBA alumni, with a third of those living outside of the U.S., That's a pretty potent network of for any graduate school. Has Harvard Business School graduates become the new Illuminati?
I think I say in the book that it may be the most powerful alumni network that ever has been. Right? They are they have significant representation among the world's wealthiest and among leadership in the corporate world. Overseas, they are in more government positions because people tend to send their kids to the States to get that stamp of credibility.
So let's talk a little bit about Jamie Dimon. Warren Buffett has described him as one of his favorite CEOs. What's your take on Mr. Dimon?
Readers of the book will see that I was impressed with him. He's one of the most charismatic CEOs I've ever met. He clearly endears people to him, and loyalty is one of his strong suits. I think his management of JP Morgan Chase pretty much stands for itself. I know that you haven't always, you've been a critic in the past, but if your job is managing,
not so much a critic of him as the banking industry's begging to be bailed out.
Sure.
How fortuitous was it that they had their big subprime disaster years before the financial crisis hit? So when they had to liquidate, there was a bid there for them to get out. It wasn't selling into the panic. Or am I giving them too much credit?
One of the things that I criticize the case method of teaching at HBS for is that they allow corporate executives to claim foresight when it was just circumstance and
right.
luck. In Last Man Standing, I talk about the fact that they were trying to get the pieces of the conveyor belt all moving at the right time, and we're a step behind some of the other players like Merrill. And there was luck there. But at the same time, I had numerous people tell me from inside the company that Jamie and the people who work with him had sort of suddenly feeling on alert a little before everyone else.
Well, I'm doing this from memory. And in my book, when I was researching Bailout Nation, Bank of America was a disaster. Merrill Lynch, go down the list. Countrywide, Morgan Stanley. Notably missing from the parade of terribles was J.P. Morgan. And when you do the deeper dive, you find out, they had a derivative snafu and they had these problems with CDOs, but it wasn't right in the middle of the 08-09 where the bids just went away. I want to say it was 3 or 5 years earlier. So when they had to clean that up, the housing market was still there.
Mm-hmm.
They were able to go out to the market and work their way out of whatever it was. And I apologize if I'm getting that wrong. I'm doing this from memory. But clearly, their derivative snafu predated Bear and Lehman and AIG and everybody else. It's always better to sell into an upmarket than into a panic.
And also, and their next derivative snafu, the London Whale, was after. And I think it might be out of a little naivete on my part, but What Jamie said and what Sandy Weill had said before him is their focus on the fortress balance sheet to be able to
withstand anything,
to or buy when the streets are running with blood or whatever it is. It's that was a stated intention long before they did so.
And look what they did. They picked up Bear Stearns for a song, originally $2, ultimately $10 a share. They ended up getting that brand new Bear Stearns building, which was probably worth at that point more than the
purchase
rest of
Bear price,
Stearns.
Yeah.
And
WaMu.
And Washington Mutual. If you remember, was it Citi? Someone was maneuvering to get WaMu, and somebody who had a, let's call it, a dubious balance sheet. And when J.P. Morgan showed up, it was, you guys are done. We're going there. And I will tell you from personal experience, at the time we had a Washington Mutual account, my ATM credit card, where I used to get charged $1 or $2 at Chase, I want to say the deal took place on like a Saturday or Sunday. By Tuesday or Wednesday, the fee was gone from your. It was in 48 hours and they were off and running. It was a pretty seamless transition. And that was a pretty substantial purchase.
Yeah, and that was when, in October of that
year? Late. So
it was like, but it was still in, Lehman frenzy.
Right.
A lot of people rained a lot of hate down on the guy as their favorite, boogeyman from the financial crisis. But as a manager and as a, just from what I know him as a person and stuff, like, I couldn't be more impressed. A couple of people wrote online that, how do I square a positive biography of Jamie Dimon with a searing critique of Harvard Business School? And it's simple.
Hey, not everybody who comes out of there is
well, yeah, that's the point. It's I'm not saying everyone out of there is evil and everyone out of there doesn't know what they're doing. They're clearly very good at teaching people the things they need to do to get to the top. But as Henry Mintzberg at McGill says, getting to the top is what matters to the student and the school when it's selling itself to prospective MBA students. What matters to the rest of us is what they do once they're there.
Mm-hmm.
And in that group, Dimon clearly is a standout.
How secret is McKinsey's influence?
Yeah, I got mocked in from a couple quarters for that, saying it's no secret. to which I responded, we're trying to sell books.
Okay.
And the
2 points for honesty.
The secret part about McKinsey's influence is that when it is not for public institution or governmental body or something like that that has to disclose it, none of their work is disclosed by anyone, by the client, by McKinsey. So some of it comes to light when there is scandal or when people want to brag about it. But the large proportion of their work happens in complete secret.
And hence the McKinsey mystique you write about.
Absolutely. Yeah. So these guys are behind the scenes interviewer or behind the scenes consultants who I make a point in the book that what they do is they sell credit to their clients for their ideas. Right. So McKinsey.
Say that again. They sell credit
for their ideas.
In other words, they'll give the client the idea and say, hey, you could take credit for this.
They never claim credit for it. Right. Because no CEO wants to hire them, say, tell me to do acquisition A or B.
Right.
And then they do A. And McKinsey's over there saying, that was our idea.
Right.
Then that doesn't happen. But the trade-off is that McKinsey says, we will take no credit, but we will also take no blame.
Except no blame. So let's talk a little bit about that blame. You and I were chatting. Not looking to sell books, headlined a column once called, this is from 2011, is McKinsey & Company the root of all evil? I must have read something you had written before you had written the book. Tell me if this quote sounds familiar. McKinsey, the global consulting firm, has created dubious strategies for all manners of companies, ranging from Enron to General Electric. Indeed, wherever there has been a financial disaster in the world, if you look around somewhere in the background, McKinsey & Company is nearby. And let me throw some of these out at you and you tell me your thoughts. Side pockets and off-balance sheet accounting, leading it to become known as the firm that built Enron.
Jeff Skilling was McKinsey, also HBS.
Beforehand, right?
Yeah, before Enron.
Oh, so he hid for the cycle.
Yeah.
HBS, McKinsey, and then Enron.
And then
that
jail.
That is a perfect Right. That's the full foursome.
So, and while he was at Enron, he continued to use McKinsey to the tune of $10 million a year in fees.
Nice.
They hired MBAs, mostly Harvard MBAs, and had McKinsey consultants write fawning articles and books like The War for Talent and stuff about their off-balance sheet accounting, talking about how this new asset light company was the company of the future, and they were cheerleading all the way.
McKinsey argued that New York City was losing derivative business to London and therefore should more aggressively pursue derivative underwriting. How did that work out?
In the firm I talk about, in the fallout from the crisis, McKinsey was advising almost every single institution that collapsed. So back to the
That's
secret
awesome.
Part. We don't know what their advice was, but it certainly wasn't go in the direction of less, not more.
It's not just financial firms they've advised that collapsed. They gave some advice to British railway company Railtrack. The advice was spend less on infrastructure, which led to a series of fatal accidents, and eventually Railtrack collapsed. Swiss Air implemented a McKinsey strategy, which was very helpful in eventually pointing them to bankruptcy. Now, we could argue, is that just a coincidence or not? Allstate did a auto claims payout reduction. It was a McKinsey & Company strategy. It wasn't that they were helping them manage how to do their payouts. They were reducing their legitimate claimants' payouts, and they lost a bunch of business over it and had some states look. I don't remember the outcome in the book, but there were states that had reviewed all states, state insurance.
Oh, that I talk about that in the book.
Yes.
That's probably the most disgusting piece of consulting I came across from McKinsey.
Really?
Yeah, from McKinsey.
Well, the one that I think had the most, the biggest financial impact, and we'll come back to Allstate. So GE followed their advice before the crisis and lost $1 billion. But the one that blows my mind, a little company called Bell Labs out of AT&T, eventually they changed their name to Lucent, invented the cell phone. But they didn't pursue it because McKinsey advised them, ain't no future in mobile phones. I mean, stop and think about that. How does that not justify a corporate death sentence when you manage to say to somebody, like if your advice is this whole mobile future technology thing ain't going anywhere, who would ever hire you again with that sort of expertise?
It's a great question. I make the point in the book that there are 10 reasons to hire McKinsey. Only one of them is the advice that they give you.
What are the other nine? Give us some highlights.
Let me see if I have nine. One is to show that you can afford them.
Oh, so
they are a luxury good.
Okay, it's a signaling situation.
It's a signaling thing.
Right? That's funny.
If you are the CEO and you aren't sure what to do, you're not going to ask your number two, or at least you're not going to display your level of uncertainty.
Mm-hmm.
They are a great use of corporate money for personal, you know, decision-making help. If you are the CEO of a company who needs to get rid of your number two because you're feeling him getting a little close to you, they are a wonderfully effective way of having a knife stuck in their back that does not have your fingerprints on it. You can restructure that person out with McKinsey's advice. If you've made a decision, you need to get it by your board. McKinsey told us to do it.
Right.
If you want to have the McKinsey works for everybody, right? So if you want the benefit of that knowledge, I'm sure they don't go around sharing one client's stuff with another client, right?
But,
that
but
would
they
be the
say
death knell.
We have some insight into.
They
this
have
industry.
Insight because they're talking to everybody else.
Right.
So if you're the only one who's not talking to them, you're the only one who's not getting the benefit of that exposure. Bad advice.
Right. To me, it sounds like if someone could say, as a corporation, like, why do I feel that Apple and Amazon don't listen to McKinsey, or am I technologically naive?
No, you know, companies that know what they're doing,
uh-huh,
and or sort of know what their plan is, they don't need them as much.
So,
except if you want to use them as the in their most modern incarnation, which is the great rationalizers. They are the people you bring in to cut costs so that you can point your finger and say, I didn't want to do this. McKinsey.
Really?
Yeah.
So as an investor, why would I want my company to spend all those millions of dollars to doing what the management has been hired to
do? That's a good point. That was what I was saying that Jamie was talking about when he was criticizing general use of consultants. But no, what McKinsey's business model is about personal relationships, right? They have relationships with the CEO. Yes, they burrow into companies, but it's about personal things. So you're absolutely right that if you're a shareholder, like I say in the book, no CEO is an idiot for hiring them for all the reasons I just listed. Why wouldn't you?
Sure.
It's somebody else's money. But yeah, shareholders, unless you know, it's one of those situations where you need the hiring of McKinsey to signal that you're serious about your reorganization or your cost cutting, and you want the market to know that you really mean it because you're going to spend the money, and then
you're not just giving lip service. Yeah. Hey, and this time we mean it.
Yeah.
So what's the relationship with McKinsey and Harvard, which goes back? Harvard Business Review was where they were publishing early on. How did that dynamic develop?
Marvin Bower, who was the longtime spiritual godfather and leader of McKinsey after James McKinsey died, was the one who had the insight. Early on, consulting firms hired experienced professionals. So if you're an airline company and you want advice, they had like a retired airline CEO on the staff, and you'd ask him because he knew what he was talking about. And Bower, his contemporaries in the maybe 40s or so, were like, wait a second, why don't these MBA schools are popping up all over the place? Why don't we hire them? They're cheaper, way cheaper. We can mold them into our own image and create this army of whatever they
are. Generate case studies on specific industries.
We can have them learn on the client's dime, right? So why wait till they retire? So McKinsey was one of the first companies to really hire out of HBS with in earnest. And ever since then has been, in sum, there is no company that has hired more HBS grads than McKinsey.
Really?
Goldman, I think, would be second. Maybe not. It might be like GE or something. But McKinsey's number one. And they hire them because the case method is the perfect education and preparation for being a consultant. You're supposed to stand up in front of a group of people and talk about something that you don't really know a lot about and sound convincing.
We have been speaking with Duff McDonald. He is the author, most recently, of The Golden Ticket, about Harvard Business School, and previous to that, The Firm, The Story of McKinsey. We love your comments, feedback, and suggestions. Write to us at mibpodcast@bloomberg.net. Check out my daily column at bloombergview.com. You can follow me on Twitter @Ritholtz. I'm Barry Ritholtz. You're listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio.
If you're having a business dispute, the process can be slow and drawn out, especially if you rely on litigation in the courts. You can wait for years before your case is resolved, and the longer your case proceeds, the more your case can cost. Not with the American Arbitration Association. Arbitration or mediation with the American Arbitration Association is faster. In fact, nearly 50% of our cases settle prior to hearings. ADR.org. Resolve faster.
Welcome to the podcast. You know what question I forgot to ask you during the broadcast? If people want to find your work, they could go to duffmcdonald.com.
Yes.
As well as Amazon and find bookstores everywhere.
Yes.
So you have a list of all of your publications and everything else.
I have my books there, and I have my greatest hits.
Okay.
Journalism wise.
There you go. So let's go over some of the stuff. Some of the stuff that we missed. You know what I didn't get to ask you that I wanted to chat about was the ascent of CEO pay. And who would you blame for it? Is that McKinsey? As some people have said, and I have a quote from you somewhere here about McKinsey, which is McKinsey to blame for skyrocketing CEO pay? You go back to the early pay consultants, it seems that McKinsey was back part of that.
Yeah, there was a consultant at McKinsey who did a CEO pay study, and it was post-World War II, I think.
Back when the ratio between CEOs and the lowest paid people on the factory floor were like 25 to 1.
Yeah, so, yeah, in the double digits. And the one study that they did found that executive, over some trailing period, 5 years or something, executive pay had risen more slowly than worker pay. And suddenly that study was in very high demand by corporate boards. And that led to the Harvard Business Review publishing an annual study. And there you get your perpetual motion machine being built. And
now we're up to 400 or so to one.
And you have compensation committees made up of fellow CEOs who think that they are worth $50 million a year, so therefore, why shouldn't this guy be? And I call it in the Golden Passport, and we may have to cut this for the censors, the one of the most intricately designed circle jerks in business history.
Because everybody is log rolling for the future. Everybody is. I remember back in the day when Spy magazine would show log rolling in our time, and it's Duff McDonald says, Ritholtz's book is great. And Ritholtz says, Duff McDonald's book, must read. And they would always show the matching blurbs.
That's great.
And that has stayed with me for all these years.
That's awesome.
Log rolling in our time. I'm old enough to remember when Spy magazine was actually, you know, the Onion before the Onion was
right,
the Onion.
Right.
So that's kind of interesting. There's a really fascinating NPR Planet Money about how a Clinton tax basically changed the dynamics of CEO compensation and led to people saying, all right, let's give them a lot of stock options because that doesn't cost us anything.
I talked about that in the Golden Passport too as one of the greatest examples of unintended consequences ever. They tried to put a cap on CEO pay.
Cash pay. Was it like $1 million?
$10 million.
And above that, the taxes became onerous.
Right. So what two things happened from that? One is average CEO pay was not $10 million at the time, but it quickly converged
right up to it.
On $10 million. And stock options. So
which became enormous.
So a well-intentioned move by Clinton blew up in the country's face.
So you have the tax policy, and then on top of everything else, you have the FASB accounting that basically says, well, stock options really aren't a cost. You know, just because you have to actually go out and buy it in the market doesn't mean it's a cost to the shareholders.
And if they are, you might be able to reprice them anyway after the fact.
So that was just one of those things. And when people look at how CEO pay has run away, that's one factor. But there has to be the consultants are one thing. The tax change is something else. The accountant treatment is something else. Any other factors?
HBS, I lay some blame at their doorstep for helping build the CEO fame machine, right? So the case method teaches from the perspective of the CEO, what would you do? How would you save this company? You.
Right.
And then Fortune Magazine.
McKinsey, Harvard, and what were you about to say about Fortune?
Then Fortune will put you on their cover and tell you that you are the world's greatest person because you know how to price pharmaceuticals properly or something.
Right. You just crank them up towards 100 times more what you paid for them, and there you go.
Right.
It's
and buy some patent protection from your...
Got to modify the pharmaceutical every year so you extend that 70-year lifespan. You're
and this
good.
Is tricky stuff, so you deserve the fame for doing it.
Now, how do you explain that in Europe and in Asia we don't see the same enormous pay packages. They might be starting to tick up, but they're nowhere near what we do here in the United States.
I think Martin Sorrell is overpaid. He's the WPP.
Okay.
Sir Martin Sorrell.
Oh, there you go. Well, once you're knighted, then whatever you...
Right, right, you deserve it all. I think it's because, like, as some historians, business historians point out, one of the ones who I found particularly insightful is a guy named Robert Locke, who's been living in Germany for some
L-O-C-K-E?
Time. L-O-C-K-E. And he talks about the fact that there's two oppositional stances in American business. One is business versus government, mm-hmm. and one is management versus worker.
Sure.
Right? And neither of those has to be. And in other variants of capitalism, like Germany, neither of them is nearly as polarized
right.
as it is here. And the management values the input of their employees, I think, a little more than they do in the States, especially if they've gone through the fame machine of a place like HBS, where you're convinced that you are the reason for all success, and you blame government or unions for your failures. So think in at least the Japan as well as Germany, they're a little calmer about what constitutes success and what its origins are, and they're not so obsessed with trying to take credit for it. Mm-hmm. So they're better at sharing it.
That's quite fascinating. I know I only have you till about 6 for another half hour. I'm gonna see what else we skipped before getting to my 10 favorite questions. You know, we kind of blew through the journalism portion of our first segment. Let's talk a little bit about journalism. And you explained how you sort of serendipitously happened into writing. What are some of the things you really like about writing books, and what are the things that perhaps you are not so enthralled with?
It's great for me, at least, as a freelancer. This is a practical answer.
Mm-hmm.
Freelancing got really. I sort of had a nice 3 or 4 year run of freelance magazine writing before the crisis, and it was really fun.
Mm-hmm.
When money got tight, freelance got a lot more difficult. Writing books is easier on from a cash management perspective.
Really? Yeah. So you put out 3 books in 10 years?
Yeah. And
what's the next book that's coming out?
My agent is hounding me to get it to the publisher now, because the reviews for the Golden Passport are so good. So we're
right.
trying to
you've
finish
been, by the way, you've been everywhere the past. By the time this broadcast, the past month or so, really nicely reviewed in all sorts of major publications. So they want to strike when the iron is hot. Is that the business side?
So financially, it's been it's worked for me. As far as what do I like about it from the actual process itself, if there is a criticism of the latter two books that I just don't care about, it's that they focus a little too much on the history. I love the history.
You have to tell that
story.
Yeah,
I think it's fascinating.
Just tell me what happened Tuesday. Who cares? That's a different...
Yeah, that's Bloomberg,
right?
Right.
But that's for 2 million companies, so it's a lot of volume. This is one company. You want it to be a mile deep.
Yeah, and I love... the reporting part of it, there was a point in my career, I think it was at Money Magazine, you know, when you're writing personal finance, it's hard to get that motivated for it. I remember when I would be calling people, I would actually be hoping they didn't answer their phone.
That's a warning sign that you're doing
that you're in the wrong job.
Yeah.
Now it's like, once I'm on to a subject I like, just all you're doing is reading and talking to people who are introducing you to other people who are introducing you to other people. It's great.
Right.
Like, all you're doing is spending your time learning stuff. And if you're interested in it, you know, what a way to make a living. The writing stuff. I've gotten more confident with each successive book. This last one is a little in places intemperate, but that
well, wasn't the firm somewhat intemperate throughout?
Yeah, although I was amazed, there were people who were confused about what my true opinion of McKinsey.
What?
And it's like, do you...
The root of all evil. How confusing is that? When you say root, do you mean like potato?
Never read between the lines before?
I thought it was pretty clear that
it
you
was,
were...
That's what I thought too, but... So I in this book, I tried to make sure that didn't happen in this book.
When you say they're terrible, do you mean they're like pretty good or what do you mean by terrible? I mean, did you really get pushback on the McKinsey book?
Yeah, there were people who said he asked a question, are they worth it or not? And he doesn't give a satisfactory answer. And my response-
You gave 10 bullet points as to-
It's like, it depends who you are.
Right.
If you are the CEO, yes. If you're the shareholder, maybe. If you're society, probably not, unless you rate efficiency as the highest value of all.
And is that really what they do? Are they really the efficiency masters?
Yeah, all they do is come in and optimize stuff for you.
Mm-hmm. Regardless of consequence.
Yeah, and you know, they have a sort of a boilerplate approach to problem solving and thinking that works very well in process situations.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want someone to come in who is outside of your organization, so who doesn't come with baggage and can do stuff without personal bias.
No ties, no obligations.
Nothing, and they
just
come in, lop
off heads and move on.
Yeah.
It's like hiring samurai to just, okay, kill everybody
exactly.
in this village.
They are corporate samurai.
Right, and then leave.
Yeah.
That's pretty interesting. So, Journalism Today, how do you feel about or think about the rise of fake news, and is there anything we could do about it?
I think it's horribly depressing that we were able to elect... a president who so willfully is like trampling
the press.
Just sort of the essence of like what is truth. Like, yes, we can all have different opinions,
sure.
right? But not
different facts.
We should be able to agree at what day of the week it is
right.
or
right.
what the temperature is outside. And the fact that we've ended up, you know, in a situation where nobody believes anybody who's. They have decided is not trustworthy. It's horrible.
There was just an interesting article. I'm trying to remember where I saw it. It was either AP or McClatchy that said his tweets have lost influence. The president's tweets, they no longer move markets. They no longer disrupt things. Even when he comes out, as he did a month or so ago, and said, yeah, we should break up the big banks. The market sputtered for about 90 seconds and then quickly recovered all its losses. At one point in time, his sort of freeform, disruptive, you know, machine gunning had an impact.
That's because everybody's freaking out that we managed to elect him.
Well, you know, it's if you look around the world, what's been happening, you have the Brexit vote, you have the Le Pen vote, you have Donald Trump. The rise of populism, around the world has ramifications. You've railed against the financial elite. Many voters, both here and abroad, are doing the same thing. And so what's kind of surprising is a lack of pivot from Trump once he's elected to say, all right, I have the wind on my back, let's do ABC. And instead it's this sort of odd... All right, let's check out Spicer gets great ratings. Let's keep him. Wait, that you haven't figured out what your new job. You have a new job. Figure out what you're supposed to do and try not to blow us all up. That transition doesn't seem to have happened.
I think it's because he never expected to win. And
I 100% couldn't agree with you more. Yeah. That's why there are so many unappointed positions. Normally you go in with a list of these 3,000 people and here are our top 100. That didn't happen. I think he's as surprised as anybody.
You know, back to the journalism thing and the fake news thing, one thing that has occurred to me, though, is like the internet has allowed us to be aware of more people's opinions mm-hmm. than the media's opinions.
True.
Which, you know, historically, or whoever was on TV and stuff.
It, what does that do for us?
Well, it. My point is just, we might not have actually gone through such a significant change with fake news. We may have been in this state before, but mm-hmm. didn't really realize it.
So you have more opinions, some of which are paid shills for one side or the other, some of which are just clearly click-hungry Macedonian teenagers putting up scam websites, and some, you know, not every... When two people are having an argument and one says, well, the earth is an oblate spheroid, and the other person says, no, the earth is flat, that's not a credible debate. And on top of everything else, our cognitive systems are set up so that even when someone is wrong, they don't, and you correct them, they don't remember the correction. If anything, it hardens their erroneous view. And there's all sorts of crazy stuff.
You know what's funny is on that point, I say that one of my points in the Harvard book is that they have spent so much time telling themselves that they have a moral righteousness to their leader, their as an aspect of their leadership. It's like you telling the story of something that happened so many times that suddenly, like on your 50th telling, a thing that you weren't sure about the first time you told it, you're suddenly it's a fact now
because you've been speaking to my wife, haven't you?
Yeah.
She doesn't understand how the story gets better each telling, and I'm like, that is editing, of course. And in all seriousness, when they do studies on memory and witnesses, when you tell a story to the cops or whoever,
it becomes your truth.
Right. The second time you tell that, you're not recalling what you witnessed. You're recalling the previous discussion. And so the more you tell it, the further and further it gets away from the original experience, which is why you're supposed to take contemporaneous notes and blah blah blah. So I could talk about this sort of stuff forever. Let's get to my favorite questions so we don't end up keeping you here all night. All right, so you told us what you did before working as a journalist. You were at Goldman Sachs for 2 years. Nothing in between. From there, you went straight into writing.
My first job after Goldman was at Derivatives Week.
So you were covering derivatives as a journalist?
As a journalist.
That sounds...
During the... when I think it was Air Products or something, one of the first big derivatives blow-ups.
Right.
In 94.
Oh, really? And, oh, this is way back.
Yeah. And the guy there said to me, what are you doing? All of the people who work here want to work on Wall Street. You're first person who's ever come from Wall Street to work
McLean
here.
Did the same thing.
Yeah, and then he said, how do I know you're not going to go back to Wall Street? And I said, I'm not going back to Wall Street.
Right.
6 months later, I left for Money Magazine, and he,
which was a Dow Jones publication.
No, Time Inc.
Time Inc.
So
okay.
he pulled
Smart
me,
Money was Dow Jones.
Yeah, he pulled me into his office. He said, "You told me you weren't going to leave," and I said, "I told you I wasn't going back to Wall Street. I didn't tell you I wasn't going to go to a better publication." So I then was at Money for 5 years, and realized it was time to quit when I had written the exact same story twice.
Right.
Because service magazines. If you're actually good at what you do at a service magazine, you should write the same story probably.
Jason Zweig said his job is to write the same story week in, week out, and not let his readers or his editors know that he's doing
that. Yeah, totally. I worked with Jason. Mm-hmm. And at that point, I got an offer. Red Herring Magazine was growing during...
I remember, 90s.
Yeah, Internet 1.0. And they hired me as their New York bureau chief. And public markets editor, because they were all VC and private equity.
So tell us about some of your early mentors.
I can come up with three. One was a guy named Michael Civi at Money Magazine.
The name is familiar. Writer or editor?
Writer slash editor.
Mm-hmm.
But he was sort of the central financial writer for years. Fascinating guy, his method of writing, it could, you know, could bore you to tears given its repetitive aspects, but it was very effective. So he was the one who taught me sort of the simplicity and clarity were key. The next one was Jason Ponton, who was the editor of Red Herring magazine. He's at MIT Tech Review now.
Mm-hmm.
And he brought a flair to Red Herring that was eye-opening for me coming out of a service magazine like Money. And, you know, he sort of prayed at the altar of The Economist.
Mm-hmm.
And he made me realize when I wasn't even sure of it, that writing could be like a joyous experience as mm-hmm. opposed to a mind-numbing one. And then the next one was someone who just died, actually, Christopher Byron.
Oh, sure.
Who was
at The Observer.
He was at The Observer. I had the good fortune to follow in his footsteps, writing a similar column in The Observer. I hired him at Red Herring to write for us because I thought he was so great. And he was the one who showed me how to write with attitude when without fear and taking aim at the right targets. You know, I spent most of my early career doing positive stories. Here's something you should do. It's a great idea.
Mm-hmm.
And at Red Herring, here's some great technologies. Here's a great trend. These are all fascinating and awesome things. And turns out it's just as fun to call people to account for...
more fun.
Yeah, it's more fun. And I can't think of another writer who inspired me more with his writing than Christopher Byron. No one even comes close.
Huh, that's really interesting. Tell us about what other journalists influenced how you write.
Byron would be number one. I'm not sure I have, you know, the guys who Graydon Carter is head at Vanity Fair doing business writing.
It's used to be the publisher of Spy. And that's where the phrase short-fingered vulgarian was published. And that has to be 20, 25 years ago.
Yeah, and he is...
And it's still following.
It's a great... it's like any publication. It has its ebbs and flows. But he is a great... He's one of the great editors.
Mm-hmm.
And he hires great writers.
Mm-hmm. Vanity Fair is a monster.
Yeah,
these days.
You know, Michael Lewis is there. Mm-hmm. Bethany McLean is there. William Cohan is there. Brian Burrow is there. You know, what else? Who else do you need?
Right.
Me, Graydon. I'm available. the way that they do business stories at Vanity Fair,
right.
I wrote for them.
They're deep, in-depth.
Yeah, I did like
form.
A decade's worth of work with them. Graydon mm-hmm. gave me, you know, was awesome enough to give me a lot of work for a while when I was freelance. That's how you do a good business story.
Right.
Those guys do it better than anybody.
They put a lot of. I was quoted by them in something. I think three different fact checkers called me. It was. Nobody uses that, does that sort of depth of...
Yeah, and if you read that stuff and put it up side by side with Fortune, like the people at Fortune, where I've been a contributor, they should be embarrassed of themselves.
So you're not going to be a contributor anymore,
no.
apparently.
that's real storytelling. So Graydon, but then if there is like one name who I read, not with an eye to trying to write like him, because it will never happen,
right?
But who I read just because it brings me...
Joy?
A euphoric something is Adam Gopnik at The New Yorker.
Oh,
he
really?
Is the greatest, in my opinion, he's the greatest writer
really?
Of all the journalists.
No kidding.
Yeah.
I get The New Yorker. I've seen his, by the way, they have a killer lineup.
They got a murderer's
well.
Row too.
Ryan Leeson, and go down the
Sheila
list.
Sheila Kohatkar just joined them. She's an old.
She's a former poet. Bloomberg person who just had the book out on hedge funds.
Yeah.
Shark something, I forgot the name, Predators something. We'll figure out what that is. They just have a monstrous lineup. The problem is that the magazines don't stop coming. You can't get your Vanity Fair is monthly, is that right?
Yeah.
New Yorker is like every other day, it seems. In
yeah,
New
I used to, I had times where
up.
I stopped subscribing to the New Yorker because the piles would give me
right.
guilt.
I just want the online access. Stop mailing me.
Yeah,
the
get that. Get the.
The app.
No, there's an app called Texture.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing. It's $15 a month. You get every magazine there is.
Really?
Yeah.
I'm done with getting.
Yeah,
stuff
don't get this
up.
Straight up from them. Get it through Texture. It's awesome.
Usually, I hate the Expedia / you know, hotels.com. I want to go directly. It's
no,
cheaper,
no, this one's
better.
Right. It's awesome.
This is all right. I will definitely check out Texture. Let's talk about, since we're talking about writers, let's talk about books. That's Charlie Pellett, Voice of the Subway.
Mm-mm.
When you hear "Stand Clear of the Closing Doors,"
oh, no way.
That's him. Let's. By the way, for people who are listening, we're in a glass terrarium, the studio, and there's an endless parade of people walking by, and some of them wave, and I'm trying not to be distracted, but, you know, it's Bloomberg.
When you got
and
two famous
happens.
People like us in
yeah,
here,
that's
everybody
right.
stares, right?
So let's talk about books. What are some of your favorite books? Who are some of your favorite authors? By the way, this is the single most requested question I get from listeners.
So... before I was a journalist, I would say the balance of my reading was probably 90% fiction, mm-hmm. 10% nonfiction. And even these days, if you don't include the reading I do for work, it's probably 70-30 fiction.
So give us some fiction names and give us some nonfiction names.
Fiction... I lean to people like Borges, Italo Calvino, Nabokov.
Give some book titles.
Borges' book, Labyrinths, mm-hmm. short stories. It's fantastic. Italo Calvino's book, If on a Winter's Night a Traveler, Invisible Cities.
Mm-hmm.
Nabokov, Everything.
Right.
David Foster Wallace, I was a fan of. I thought the sort of verbal pyrotechnics there were great. In recent years, I rediscovered Stephen King from when
just
I...
Just had a long conversation about
him. I read Under the Dome on a trip a couple years ago. It's like his latest fat one,
uh-huh.
like the size of the stand and stuff. He's still got it.
Matt Wallert is a former principal at Microsoft Ventures. And we were talking about Stephen King. He said he likes to every now and then find an author and just devour the entire
oeuvre. I used to do that all the time.
Just straight. I used to do that with science fiction. Not so much.
My brother
with,
does that.
Right. We'll find an author and go, yeah. All right, I've now read everything.
I used to do that with fiction writers, and then I realized that I didn't want to do it anymore because it's like you use it all up and you want to savor right. some of it for later.
Right.
I like... there's a couple that are obvious ones that are...
What about nonfiction?
I'm not, you know, considering that I've read written a biography, I'm not a huge reader of biographies. Mm-hmm. I thought The Power Broker was one of the
Robert
greatest.
Robert Caro on Robert Moses.
On Robert Moses, you know, it's a kind of
an
imposing
book
but yeah. it is awesome.
Yeah.
I plowed
through
that thing.
Been on my shelf for decades, literally decades.
You know what? It was on my shelf too, and then when I sold the Jamie Dimon book, I was like, I should read a biography. And I took that out to a friend's house in Amagansett by myself for a weekend and read it. And at the end of it,
you
I was
read
like,
that in a weekend.
No, sorry, I was out there for a couple days.
A month, yeah.
And I was, as soon as I finished, I was like, oh my God, what have I done? I can't do this. I can't write anything close to this.
It won the Pulitzer Prize. Yeah. It's been lauded as one of the, greatest,
one of the greatest
biographies of all time.
Yeah. I veer more into science and math stuff than history
sure.
or contemporary.
Give us a few books. You're talking right in my sweet spot. So.
I am, you know, stuff like... all the pop science stuff, like The History of Zero.
Okay.
Or...
did you read The Information by James Gleick?
I have The Information by James Gleick. I haven't read it.
Probably the best book I read in the past decade.
Consciousness Explained, one
okay.
of my favorite books, Daniel Dennett.
Yep.
Best book I've ever read in the last decade was an Adam Gopnik book called... I don't know if this is the name of it, but it's... Lincoln and Darwin or Darwin and Lincoln.
Okay.
And it is like a dual biography.
Parallel lives sort of thing?
Parallel lives, more like parallel thought mm-hmm. and parallel changes in the way they helped the rest of us change the way we think through the way they did what they did.
Mm-hmm.
And I told people afterwards, I was like, I never would have read a biography of Darwin or of Lincoln, and I certainly wouldn't have read a joint one, except it was Gopnik.
Right.
And it is one of the greatest books
really?
Ever. Yeah.
Oh, my. Well, I'm going to add that to my list for sure. That's a decent number. Give me one more.
Oh, I'm blanking.
Because I see you're thinking about a lot
here.
Of...
My favorite, I think, multi-book reading experience in the last 20 years or so was Neal Stephenson's Baroque Trilogy.
Okay.
With each of those books was 1,000 pages long.
Right.
And I was reading one of them when I moved at some point, and the book ended up in a box in the attic, and I forgot about it and found it a decade later and then finished the trilogy.
Really?
And it is...
Just picked it up where you left off and just plowed through.
I don't know. I think I might have started again, but there was... there's so much in it. He is a hilarious writer. It's all about money and the history of money.
What is the big book he wrote?
He wrote Cryptonomicon.
Okay. And Neuromancer.
Snow Crash.
Right.
But the Baroque cycle, the three of them, that is like... It is... He could have just set the pen down and retired. It
Done.
Is a piece of greatness.
Wow, that's amazing. Let's move forward past books. We've already spent enough time talking about journalism as an industry. Here's another reader question. Tell us about a time you failed and what you learned from the experience.
You know, I was thinking about that one because you'd sent it to me.
Mm-hmm. These are the ones that require recall.
Oh, this one doesn't require much recall. I don't really have too many career failures.
Uh-huh.
I failed in a marriage.
Okay.
And I failed I drank
too much
alcoholically
mm-hmm.
at the same time. And
no coincidence there? Not a random correlation there?
No. And what did I learn? That I better grow up. And I did not treat her well at the end of our marriage. And it was just a colossal personal failure on so many fronts
mm-hmm.
about like responsibility and doing the right thing and not blaming other people for the things that bother you. Luckily, my ex-wife is a forgiving person.
Mm-hmm.
And, so things are okay, but it was like I just learned that how to not be a horrible person.
And my last two and favorite questions, what sort of advice would you give to a millennial or a recent college grad who came to you and said, I'm thinking about being a writer?
That's a good one. you know, if you have... you know, you're not going to accidentally end up in the situation I have, you know, been lucky to end up in anymore because it
so
was.
So what you did, you
I don't think,
think
that happens
again.
And it's not because I can do something. I just think the structure of the industry.
Everything has changed.
Everything's
it's
changed.
So different.
If you have a passion and a facility for writing, you know, you got, I think it's got, my advice would probably be targeted. You know, you got to figure out your thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, hopefully the New York Times and, you know, whoever will be around for a while, but, the price paid per dollar spent, or sorry, the price paid per word is in free fall.
Right.
And the only thing that is going to, retain its value is, A, great scoops, and B, great writing, and C, great storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
So you got to refine to do great storytelling about any particular thing. You got to know enough about it to be able to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you got to figure out what your thing is and hone it. Although I don't think I should be in a position to be telling aspiring journalists what to do because I never was one. So I don't really, I don't know how they think. Because I don't know how they thought back then.
Gotcha. And our final question, what is it that you know about writing today that you wish you knew 20 or so years ago when you were first starting out?
This is an easy one. And I could claim that I learned it, but my brother actually just said it to me
mm-hmm.
Like 2 years ago. I was getting ready to write the Harvard book, and I was spewing out, you know, some endless rant about Elton Mayo, who was, you know, a father of human resources, also a fraud. I finished telling him the story, and he said, "All right, don't take what I'm about to tell you the wrong way, please." And he goes, "You should write less like you currently write and more like you speak."
Interesting.
And the lesson there was, I've been trying too hard. Not that I've been trying too hard to like sound smart or write in a specific way.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't coming out as easily and fluidly as...
Loosen the grip a little and make
the grip
more fluid.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And
more natural sounding.
More natural, and storytelling, tell stories the way you tell stories. And don't, you know, change it because you're, you know, in putting it in written form. And, you know, part of that has to do with the legacy of who you're writing for. Like, various mm-hmm. publications won't let you write in certain ways. But the main point was just, like, relax, man,
mm-hmm.
and say it the way you want to say it, because you're effective that way. And so
find
I did it.
Your true voice. Is that a good way to say it?
Just don't. It's not take the job seriously. It's like not get all wound up in what you're doing. Just do what you're doing and be easy about it.
We have been speaking with Duff McDonald, contributing editor at the New York Observer and author, most recently, of The Golden Passport, Harvard Business School, etc., etc. If you have enjoyed this conversation, be sure and check out iTunes, SoundCloud, and Bloomberg.com, and you could see any of our other 100-plus conversations. I would be remiss if I did not thank my head of research, Michael Batnick, and our producer booker, Taylor Riggs, for helping us put these conversations together. We love your comments, feedback, and suggestions. Write to us at mibpodcast@bloomberg.net. I'm Barry Ritholtz. You've been listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. Masters in Business is brought to you by the American Arbitration Association. Business disputes are inevitable. Resolve faster with the American Arbitration Association, the global leader in alternative dispute resolution for over 90 years. Learn more at ADR.org.